I promised that I would talk about the connection between that and Lent and hope and the order of the cosmos this morning. Is your coffee cup full? Is your bladder empty? Never mind, that's personal. Trevor, a couple of weeks ago, sort of offered us this passionate, fairly layered insight in this really compressed piece of slam poetry. And then last week, Aliza, kind of did the same thing with a story, right? Just this, a lot of insight, a lot of horsepower. And I don't even say this. I've been thinking about this all week and I still don't have any decent words for it. I wish there was a way to carry, if you want, the best of the essence from all these consecutive experiences into the next one, so they accumulated somehow. But it doesn't seem to be the way it works. It seems to be more that we have an encounter with an idea or an experience, and there's something unique there that we take away, which is also a pretty lovely thought, that we can come with some confidence that there will be this little nugget, you know, that's for us. And so without hopefully diminishing any of that in any way, I want to start with a little bit of a review, because I would like to kind of carry on more or less from where I left off a couple of weeks ago. And the last time I did that without some review, Tim Penner, who is a very gracious man and a good friend, came to me afterwards and I said, so, you know, just give me a little feedback. He said, well, sort of felt like you hit the ground already running. Which, if you know Tim, know that's a fairly substantial critique. You know, it's offered with all this loveliness. But he meant it. I'm not sure I ever got where you were. Or something like that. So I'm going to review just a little bit. Because some of these ideas, when you really stop and think about them, they ripple. And they alter all kinds of things that are familiar to us. They get in there and mess around with the way we think about the whole thing. So the core idea that I've been digging around in is that how we live the story of what we say we believe has everything to do with the deepest down themes of that story. The themes that I would say operate below the waterline, that operate in the realm of our life where we're not necessarily thinking about what we believe. I mean, maybe sometimes we do, and some of us do more than others, but all of us have this stuff that operates way, way, way down somewhere. And a lot of the time, we don't even know what that stuff is until we start to poke and prod and pull and mess with things that we say we believe. And then all of a sudden we realize, holy smokes, like, something I didn't even ever think I believed is so forceful that people can smell it, people can taste it. It has an echo that goes through whatever else I say and do. And we experience this in church, right? I mean, I don't know if you've ever had this experience. You go to a church and you listen to somebody speak or something happens and you kind of go, that is so lovely. And then on the end there's like this thing that gets tagged on the end that tells you how to escape hell. And you walk out of the building going, somehow I get the feeling that whole front end was the introduction to that last 2 minutes, and that this person actually believes that that's the whole story, is how to evacuate my soul from this pit. And everything else was kind of window dressing. And even if it doesn't get said, we have these experiences, right? So the stuff that operates down there in the story is enormously powerful. It sets the tone. And everything after the tone is unpacking the tone. It's like we were talking about this at the dinner table the other day, and Kale said, yeah, it's like at the beginning of The Dark Knight, where just before even the opening credits roll, there's just this super quick shot of the Joker, and his face just comes up, and it's kind of barely lit, and you see this characteristic hand gesture of his, and he says, away we go. And then he's gone off the screen. And the whole rest of the film unpacks that. This is that stuff. This is that kind of stuff. So how, by way of review, how does the story of what most of us now think of as Christian belief begin? Well, it begins with a poem and a narrative about beginnings. It begins with some intriguing imagination-filled, vivid literature about the essence of things. And so right away, in the first chapter of the story, we run into this verse that I've talked about for the last couple of weeks, Genesis 1:1, let the land produce vegetation. And the poem that begins the story, we have this idea that creation itself is generative. That when God made the world, however we understand that to have unfolded, when God made the world, among other things that were true, is that God made the world to make more. That creation, right from the beginning of the story, is actually going somewhere. And it's going there, if you will, with or without us. It is generative. It will go where it will go. And so that's how the story starts, is with this Hebrew word, dasha, which means to produce or sprout, to keep generating. And then into that story, that crazy, radical, ancient story of a creator distinct from creation, which was a new idea in that culture, and a generative creativity, or generative creation, comes humanity to guide and to nurture and to care for, to garden, if you will, in this generative creation. And so there's the hierarchy of the cosmos as our story, if we espouse Christian faith, would have it. Creator distinct from creation, generative creation, carers for, nurturers of, guiders of, in the middle. And that's sort of the picture that we've been working with. And that those people in the middle, all of us, that humanity and humanity's mandate is captured in this Hebrew word kabash, which we often translate subdue, but it's actually very much a word about responsibility and about stewardship. And that all of that gives us right away, you know, it was the worst, best of times, it was the worst of times, like opening words. It gives us this incredibly intriguing, potent, vivid picture of a world that is good, 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 very good. That's how the story begins. And the rest of it, you know, is unpacked. That's below the waterline stuff. Lots of us grew up with a story that doesn't actually start in chapter 1. Somehow, lots of us, it seems, grew up in a story that starts in chapter 3 of Genesis, which is, of course, the section of the story that we call the fall or sin, or, you know, like this is where the snake and Eve have their chat, and Adam joins in, and it all goes off the rails, right? If the first chapters of the story give us this picture of shalom, of health and wholeness and beauty and all that is well and lovely, then what happens in chapter 3 is the disruption of shalom. What happens in chapter 3 is that shalom gets messed with. That somebody stands up in the face of shalom and says, I would rather order the universe another way. I would rather not contribute to that if it means that I'm not at the top of the hierarchy. God, get out of my seat. I'll take it from here. So we can think about that moment in the narrative as the disruption of that picture. Now, it's really, really important in all of this to understand that the action is here. The action is not someplace else. The action is not in some other part, some other realm, the heavens, below the earth. The action in this story is actually right here, where we are, in this embodied place that we live. And the reason that is important is because oftentimes, if we understand the story to begin in chapter 3 with the destruction of shalom, and we tell the story that way, oftentimes what immediately follows on that telling is that the most important thing about the story is how we can get it to behave so that our souls get evacuated from this rotten place. That's a problem, right? Because what do you do with the first
two chapters of the story. What do you do with the beginning of the story where God, Spirit, Creator, distinct from creation, infuses all of creation, blesses all of creation, and says, this stuff that I've made is good. And it never becomes ungood in that narrative. So what do you do with that? If you start the story in chapter 3, you just ignore it. Or you treat it as materially fallen. You actually live in the world as though it were comprised of things that are molecularly malevolent. Right? That the stuff is bad. The stuff is something to war against. And it's easy to kind of get that picture out of the narrative in the sense that when Shalom gets disrupted, God says to the people who are doing the disrupting, there's a cause and effect to disruption. You're going to feel the weight of your choice to live outside of the harmony and the hierarchy of Shalom. It's going to be a lot of work living there. That is not a description of a change of the material nature of the world. It's a description of what happens when we disrupt Shalom, as opposed to contributing to Shalom. But guess what? The picture contains the opportunity to contribute to Shalom in the midst of whatever the circumstances are, in the midst of whatever the challenge is. Nowhere in that narrative do we find God saying, and by the way, all of your work is futile. We'll get to this more later, but this is why we have the picture of the resurrection that we're sort of headed toward. I don't want to get ahead of the story we're in because I want to talk about Lent in a moment. But it's important to realize that this is a story of a particular creation of God and a particular disruption of the shalom of that creation, but it's not the last word about the goodness of what God has made or God's ability to redeem what God has made. So we're just going to park that on the side for just a little bit because, again, I don't want to
get ahead of the season, if you want.
Well, let's think about Lent for a moment in that context. Lent, traditionally, I mean, it's the 40 days of the Easter. It's measured in different ways in different traditions, and it all gets very technical. Fascinating if you're fascinated by those kinds of things. I'm not. What's important is its force, the direction of it. And traditionally, Lent has been a season of kind of a combined two or three emphases. Preparation, anticipation, penitence. Guess which one tends to surface the most, right? Penitence. It's a season where you give things up. Why do you give things up in Lent? Well, half of us can't even remember why we give things up in Lent. We just know that in Lent you're supposed to stop eating chocolate and having sex or something. I don't know. Give up yummy things, you know? So it's awful. Why is it awful? Well, maybe it's awful because in the end, you know, what God wants us to do is suffer. And so Lent is a season in which we actually get it. Lent is a season in which we actually behave like God wants us to behave.
Oh, this is grim.
You know, I don't know how I can go on. Oh, look, it's almost Sunday. I can behave like I want to on Sunday. Sorry, Dad. After what you said, I didn't even think about this, but anyway, there you go. You can work with this all week. It's a wonder any of my friendships survive. Anyway, but there you go, right? I mean, if we start the thing in chapter 3, if we start the story in chapter 3 as though this is bad news and we're barely getting by with the skin of our teeth because God is pissed and it's a sure good thing Jesus came because we'd all be dead, and we come to Lent starting in chapter 3 instead of in chapter 1, that's what we get. We get penitence because there's no other way to keep God from whacking us. And so maybe if we, you know, flail ourselves a little bit during Lent, we can get a little closer to God. Why? Because this is God's perspective on the whole story, isn't it? The third chapter?
Huh. Anyway, what if there was another way to think about Lent? Now, I'm not saying that giving things up for Lent is a bad idea. Even remotely.
God knows, and so do we, that the practice of stepping away from things as a Lenten discipline can be enormously fruitful. But what I want to do is I want to remind us of the why of that, because it's deeply connected to this. The reason we step away from things in Lent is so that we will pay attention. That's why we step away from things. And guess what? It works just as well to step toward things in Lent. If those are steps toward things that also make us attentive, as opposed to distracted. We specialize in distraction in our age. We have never had more tools for distraction, ever. We've never had them more immediately present. I'm a little bit, you know, ADHD to begin with, and so you hand me a smartphone, and relationally, I might as well just leave the room. Because there's all this stuff you can explore. Anybody says anything. So what about this movie? What about that idea? What about the weather? What about, you know, I can just chase it till I'm exhausted, asleep, numb. But I'm not present when I'm behaving like that, right? If we're easily distracted, we are well equipped in our time to chase that one down. It's hard for us to be attentive. And so we come to a season like Lent and think, what if the essence of this season is not chapter 3? We'll get there, okay? But what if the essence of this season is actually the way the story begins? What if what we are called to be attentive to is what God has made that is good, 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 very good? How would that change the way we operated in Lent? Or any time?
What if this Lent we decided to attend deliberately to the presence of shalom in the world wherever we travel? What if we did that? In my imagination, if we did that, there are a couple of things that might emerge. We might start to see that because we live in a story in which God has made the world and placed us in it and called the whole thing good and very good, that we are already, as humans, blessed co-creators. We are already blessed makers of what is good and very good. You know, we make things out of overflow when we're creative. I don't know if you've ever thought about this or not, but my good friend Steve Bell, this is one of the themes that he just bangs away on all the time, and I love the way he talks about it. One of the things he likes to say when he talks about the Trinity, and about the way the Trinity behaves amongst the Trinity, as far as we can tell, because of who we are, is that the Trinity, because they are full of love, has to make something. And that's us. That we are the overflow of the creative love of God. Not a side project, not something that God made because God was lonely, not something that God made so we could do God's dirty work and kind of pull it together because God had to go do something else. Not God's whipping boys and girls, not God's punching bags, not God's living reminders of just how messed up things can get so that the death of God's self could be justified, but the overflow of God's love. What a crazy thought, eh? What an awesome thought. And we, because God has blessed what God has made, materially, among other things, and then put us into that hierarchy, and said that the harmonious place for us is the place of co-creation. The harmonious place for us is the place where we cooperate with the good thing that God has made and is continuing to make with this generative creation. We are already, as humans, I'm not talking about Christians now, okay? I'm not talking about people who believe or don't believe. I'm not using that distinction. As human beings, as beings made by this God, we are already blessed co-creators. That's the order of the cosmos. That's our place in it. And when we fiddle with it, we fiddle with that thing called shalom. However we name it. Because the story of Genesis begins with who we are, not with who we are not, we need to start there too. And that means we need to start by looking for the presence of God and what is being made by us and others that is consistent with that wonderful, compelling picture of shalom that the whole story starts with. And so we can come to everything in life like this. This is a primal idea. This is one of those essential ideas that translates all over the place. We can come to our relationships with one another like this. How am I behaving in this relationship? And in this relationship, anyone, am I contributing to those kinds of things that would cause this relationship to have more and more the shape of shalom? More and more the shape of what is good and very good? More and more the shape of what is even aesthetically lovely
what is materially beautiful. What compels others, and when they encounter that relationship, to go, there's something going on here that moves me. Or not. Or why not? Work. What about my work? We talked about this a couple weeks ago, right? This idea that work is sacred, that there's not some kind of dualistic universe in this picture where there's the good work where the action really is, where we deal with spirit, and there's all the other work that we kind of have to deal with because we just have to deal with its material. And by the way, if we're really good at what's material, maybe we'll make a bunch of cash and we can give it to the guys who deal with spirit so they can do more. No. Wrong cosmos. And the one that we have the picture of at the beginning of the story, what we get to do is be wherever we are, doing whatever we do, in ways that either contribute to the shalom that God has established from the beginning of the story, and that God is moving toward the fullness of all the way through the story, or we can disrupt and rebel and push against that. God's going to do what God's going to do, right? But this business of co-creation and partnership seems to be ours, and somehow we have a lot of room in it. There's this great rabbinic saying that God begins the story by separating light from dark, and that is also our task. And when we see people doing whatever they're doing in ways that are full of this, that leak this out into the world, and I think we could probably all think of examples, right? Where we encounter things in everyday life, we just go, that's so full of light and beauty and goodness and what's right. There's something so profoundly right about that. There's something so profoundly wrong about that. Well, be attentive, because those signals inside of us are part of how we come to be aware of and attentive to the presence of God in the world. And also how we become aware of and attentive to the places where the presence of God in the world is being pushed against. And they don't have to have God labels. They don't have to have religious labels at all. They don't have to have labels, period. We're kind of inclined to that as humans, right? We're kind of like the tag things. But guess what? In my life, at least, in just a limited story, personal perspective, not saying this translates into everybody's perspective, but in my experience, I bumped into lots of things that were labeled Jesus that did not have this savor. I bumped into lots of things that weren't labeled Jesus that did. If we think that something has to be labeled right to contribute to shalom, we've missed the first couple of chapters of the story. And somehow we started it again in chapter 3, and we went, unless somebody is consciously trying to assail what happened in chapter 3, they're not in the game. Not true. Leaves out the opening line. Leaves out the opening poem, leaves out the opening narrative, leaves out the compelling picture of shalom entirely.
Well, there is a problem, of course, and it could sound like I'm ignoring it, or really overemphasizing the other side of the story, which I might be doing. But there is, of course, a problem that does come into this story in chapter 3, and however we want to call it, we want to call it the sin problem, we want to call it the death problem. It's a real problem. But here's a curious thing. And we'll get to this as we unfold this season, right? But the curious thing about the death problem is that in the Christian narrative, it's actually been dealt with. See, that's the intriguing thing. Is that there's not a denial of the problem. But the problem actually has been spoken to. This is the story of Jesus. This is the story of the resurrection. Now, if we get this muddled, and we'll unpack this more over the next few weeks, but if we get this muddled, and we think that the core of the story is actually the evacuation of our souls from, you know, a materially fallen world, if we think that's the nugget, that's the essence, then we miss the point of this. We miss the truth that what's going on in the work of Jesus is a work of resurrection, is a work of new creation. We'll come back to this again, but did it ever occur to any of you, and this only kind of started to really go off for me recently, did it ever occur to you that it's not kind of just environmentally coincidental that when Mary runs into the resurrected Jesus in the garden, she mistakes him for a gardener? He could have been any number of things.
In the Jewish mind, in the Hebrew mind, everything signifies something else. Like, it's just kind of like that. He's not a gardener by accident in that story. He's a gardener because there's a new creation. It's one where the death problem got solved. And guess what? All the way through the story, what are we doing with God? We are co-creating. We are working in the garden. We're supposed to be working for this thing that the first two chapters give us this compelling picture of. All the way through the story. But post-Jesus, we get to work at it knowing that the death problem, which is rather significant, has been addressed. Anyway, we'll come back to that. Because that's really, you know, an Easter story for every day.
All right. I said I'd kind of pull this together a little bit with the thing we just saw as well, with Beethoven and flash mobs and all that. So let me do that a little bit. If our core concern, is that the way that I'm talking about this somehow assails our motivation to be repentant, then let me just suggest this. Anybody that has ever tried to actually seriously pursue engagement with the picture that we get in those first two chapters, this picture of what is beautiful, right, good, lovely, true, all of that, anybody that has ever actually tried to live into that picture will have found very naturally along the way oodles of things to confess. All sorts of opportunities where we go, today I wasn't doing a really super great job of fostering shalom with my wife. Or maybe she wasn't with me and I was just fine. Anyways, right? Never mind, you guys. Okay. But, you know, like, it's, I mean, there's an at-home example. Pick one. Traffic. Work. Attitude. Sexuality. I don't know. Like, life, right? If we actually go full on in pursuit of fostering this picture that we have at the beginning of the story, we will quite naturally come across opportunities to say, oh, I didn't actually contribute that well. There, you know, and I can own that. Today, that action, that attitude, that did not contribute to shalom, and I confess that. I can own that. Do you see how different this is than starting the story with chapter 3, where it's like, by the way, you're a piece of, you know, and if Jesus hadn't come, man, zap, because you're rubbish. Different starting point, right? Different story. Really different.
So, if you need a motivation for confession and repentance, try the hot pursuit of shalom. And just see what happens. Just see if the pursuit of that doesn't provide very natural opportunities to say, oh yeah, I confess that. I think it probably will. But here's the thing. I am confessing so that I can get on with the business of co-creating shalom. Here. Now, today, not another time, in another place, in some other body, but here, now. That's what the Hebrew word for repentance suggests that it is, to return to the path home, which is the path to shalom. That Beethoven video, what is it that the people in that video are responding to, especially the kids who, just like kids the world over, are quite uninhibited, right? I mean, I love watching the kids in that thing. I usually just end up welling up because they're just so lovely. Now, the kid climbing the light post, I think she might be my favorite, but she's got hot competition from the little guy, you know, with the shirt that doesn't quite reach his shorts, is like conducting in the back like this. It's so awesome. And right in line with those people are the guy, is the middle-aged guy with the fantastic hair and the beard, who the camera just catches him going, right? Oh, wow. I love that. Davis was watching us. He said, man, I just hope when I'm his age, I can have hair that's half that cool. Did this hit you at all, son? Anyway. What's going on in there? What are people responding to? What's going on in terms of that response to this Beethoven playing flash mob orchestra? What if what's going on there is that there's like a crack in this misperception of the story and the light's leaking in? And when people run into it, it takes them so by surprise,
and so by storm, that unless they let their inhibitions get in the way, unless they let their rules about how they're supposed to behave get in the way, they sing and dance and smile and kind of just something happens and it comes out and it's beautiful. What if what's happening is that just for a moment, there's a little bit more savor of the hierarchy and the harmony of the cosmos happening in the city square? And people can't help themselves. They sing and they dance and they whip out their smartphones. Right? I got it. Why did you do that? I don't want to lose this. I don't want this to go away. I would like this to be for always. Digital memory never dies. It's eternal. I'm going to capture this. Why? Because I need this all the time. That's how come? And I don't have it all the time. So when I run into it, I want to keep it. What if our gig as co-creators is to do everything that we can, and by God's Spirit and people and Word and all those things that inform our imagination and our action and our consideration and all of that, what if our gig here, what if we're actually on the planet to foster that kind of moment? What if we're actually here to let the light in like that? To actually be with somebody in the checkout line in a way that makes them want to whip out their smartphone and take our picture. Because why? Because somehow we let a little bit of light in. And boy, we could use that all the time. What if that's why we're here? How would that change Lent?
I want to suggest that when we imagine these sorts of things, we are exercising the part of our mind and spirit and body that helps us tell when our thoughts, actions, and inactions of others need forgiveness and restoration, but also when they are filled with light, when they are filled with the overflowing goodness of the God who made a world that is good and put people into it and said they were very good and said, go foster that. Not because I'm angry, but because I have chosen you to be co-creators of the best of the overflow of my love. I think that's a way of looking at the world that can help us form, among other things, a moral imagination that is dynamic rather than static, one that can respond to life in creative, nurturing ways, even when life is evolving at a pace that we feel like we can't keep up with. And it also helps to foster the kinds of things in us that open into forgiveness and restoration. All these things that we need. We can shut them down. We get to kind of close them off or open them up somehow. I don't know. That sounds crazy to me, but as far as my life experience goes, it seems to be the way it works. And I think that way of life is a way of life that can open into the thing that I would call adoration. Honestly, I find it hard to adore a God that I imagine is mostly angry and capricious to boot. And somehow, I also seem to understand that I'm actually made to adore God. I'm actually made to love and worship and be with God. And it seems to me that beginning the story at the beginning,